From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party.
Okay, the holidays are here. The Christmas is the big kahuna. We asked for your stories, and you shared emotions, hopes, dreams, longings, screw-ups, joys. Everything gets amplified this time of year. It makes for tales, big and small. Let's hear them. This hour on Point, we're sharing stories at Christmas time. You can join us right now, on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your Christmas story? The one that gets told and remembered, the one you can't forget. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We asked on Twitter and Facebook and online, and you sent us stories. We'll hear from those on air this hour. There are more at our website, onpointradio.org. Plus, we welcome yours right now. Hanukkah 2, we're wide open. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. It's a time of year when people can miss home if they're far away. We got a great story from Beth in Portland, Maine, sharing a kind of Christmas miracle she experienced during some time abroad in 1979. Here's Beth.
It was before the ease of communication we have today, and I was my junior year abroad at the University of St. Andrews, traveled through Europe with a couple of friends, and for the first time in my life was not going to be home for Christmas. We ended up in Salzburg at Christmas, went to a cathedral there that was beautiful, but there was nothing familiar about the music. And Christmas morning, we ate some bread and cheese and went to the post office where one of my friends was going to place a call home, and I had decided not to because of the expense and the difficulty. We got there, and there was a three-hour wait for calls to go through. We hadn't anticipated that, so we didn't have anything to read, but we bought a copy of the International Tribune and very carefully read the entire thing. And here I'll pick up from a letter to my parents where I described our day, and I said, Betsy and I went downstairs and bought a three-day-old International Tribune. We split it into three sections. I spent an hour reading about the hostages, Dusty the Kangaroo, who is promoting a cleaner Britain, and the New York Stock Exchange. I started to read a couple of articles in the back page, but I felt depressed and interested. I then turned to the classifieds on the back, and there was your message. You don't know what it meant to see it there. I promised myself I wouldn't cry, and now I can't stop. I was saddened, very sad, not to be home for Christmas, but the tears only came at the joy of seeing the message, which I had thought to look for but never thought I would see. I had been hoping for a Christmas surprise and had almost given up. I had decided there would be no Christmas this year, but I was wrong. I had realized that Christmas comes from within, but with no visible contact with home, I was beginning to have a lot of trouble finding the spirit of it. So that was my little Christmas miracle on the floor of the post office in Salzburg, Austria in 1979.
1979, Christmas story there from Beth in Portland, Maine, finding greetings from her parents in the back pages of the International Herald Tribune on the floor of the post office in Salzburg, Austria. We welcome your Christmas stories today. Share. We're right here, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And we've got stories coming in online. Brian says, I drive a semi-truck, so I end up in holiday traffic every holiday. And here's his story. He says, a few years back, I ended up stuck on I-80 near the I-81 interchange in a traffic jam caused by a Christmas snowstorm and a couple of accidents. Somewhere around the two-hour mark, people were starting to run out of gas in stopped traffic, and I realized that the family in the minivan next to me had shut down their engine to save fuel. That sounds cold. It so happened that I had fueled up not long before, says our big rig driver, and I had enough diesel to idle for a week. And that's how, Brian writes to us, I ended up sharing a warm cab with a family from Indiana along with some excellent Christmas dinner leftovers courtesy of their grandmother and my microwave in his big rig cab. The two kids played cards with their mom in the sleeper while the dad and I BS'd up front and watched a truly epic snowball fight rage up and down the interstate. Last I saw them, they were joining the line of cars heading into a gas station at the next exit. All in all, much more fun than the usual traffic jam, for me at least, from Brian Dalton, big rig driver, and his Christmas story right there. Let's get one from London, Connecticut, if we can. Barclay's calling. Hi, Barclay. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, me and my wife, we've been doing this now for 3 years. We'd always pick a family, and we'd help them out, you know, with our Christmas. So this one family we decided to help that, the husband, he ended up getting cancer and lost his job.
Wow.
And they have three children, mm-hmm. and one was a newborn. And so we decided to help the family. We got news from our church, and we decided to help the family. Well, we got them all, you know, gave them a great Christmas, and they was more than all happy about it. So when this year we was going through it, and we asked about the family health the year before, they said they're still having a rough time. So we contacted them, and we done it again for the same family this year. And we got a news update from the wife. She called us over and she said, you know what? You all have been absolutely amazing in being able to give our kids a Christmas. We just found out that he is now cured of his cancer and he's going back to work. He starts back to work in January and he goes, next year, we're going to do the same thing just to pay it forward, to pass it on. So it was a good, nice Christmas story that makes you feel good.
Yeah. It sure does, Barclay. Hey, Barclay, when you did Christmas for this family, what did that mean? What did you do? Did you take dinner? Did you take gifts? What did you do exactly?
We do two things. We buy the gifts for the kids. So we buy a couple of gifts for each kid. And then we would give them some gift cards for like Kroger and stuff so they could go and buy and feed, you know, get what they wanted for dinner and stuff like that for Christmas. And so that's what we did. So every year we usually try to find a family and sponsor that family, give them a Christmas, because me and my wife, we don't have any kids. So that was how we always give back.
Barclay, we love the story. It's just terrific. And now they're ready to pass it forward, and that's beautiful as well. I really appreciate you sharing that with us, Barclay. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Good Christmas to you. Barclay in London, Kentucky there. I've got a story here that came in from Seattle, Washington, from Jennifer, a listener in Seattle. She called in with a story, sometimes they're a little crazy, about finding a wreath when she was home, a wreath for the front door.
It was my first Christmas home from college after my parents got divorced, and I was staying with my mom, who recently moved to a new house. Things weren't quite settled there yet, so to cheer the place up, she handed me $50 to buy a nice wreath for the front door, something that would impress the curious neighbors. That seemed like an awful lot of cash for some pine needles. I was more than happy to run the errand, knowing that I would be able to pocket the change and spend it on rounds of candy cane jello shots later that evening while partying with my friends. The nursery I stopped at had stunning wreaths with all the bells and whistles, but as it turned out, $50 really was the going rate for one of those beauties. I wasn't feeling very merry as I approached the checkout, but then something caught my eye. It was an extra large wreath for only $10. It didn't have any decorations on it, but I was certain that I could find the perfect red velvet bow in one of the 200 moving boxes back at the house. What a bargain, I thought. I went to pay, and the clerk asked me if I needed steaks to go with her. Steaks? I wasn't sure what he meant by that, so I said, no, thank you. Happy holidays. I shoved the enormous wreath in my car and proudly drove home. 40 extra dollars to burn and the biggest wreath in town. It was a Christmas miracle. Except when I got home, I wasn't able to attach it to the door. Why would they sell wreaths that don't have hooks to hang them? Anxious to go meet up with my friends, I mailed it to the front of the house without the perfect red velvet bow, because, of course, I couldn't find the perfect red velvet bow. The next morning, my mother woke me up and furiously asked me why I bought a grave blanket and hung it on the house. A what? My foggy head could not comprehend her question. She screamed, "It's a grave blanket. It belongs in a cemetery, you—" Oh, it made sense now. That's why the sales guy asked me if I needed steaks. I told her I would take it down, but she said to leave it. There was no more money for another one. I felt incredibly guilty, but then I bursted out into uncontrollable laughter, the kind of laughter that sends you to your knees crying. It was an Addams Family Christmas, but at least we were all alive to celebrate it.
Okay, an Addams Family Christmas. They're from Seattle, where Jennifer bought a grave blanket instead of a Christmas wreath for the front door. Jennifer Schars in Seattle, Washington. Terrific to get that story from you. And thanks so much for sharing it. We've got more stories on tape. We've got more coming in on the phone lines. We're happy to hear yours. We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We're talking about Christmas stories, your Christmas stories of family, food, mishaps, wonder, trials, and joys, the holiday stories of your family lore. Christmas to Hanukkah, you name it. You can join us. What's your craziest, most wonderful Christmas story? What's the tale you tell kids about that one wacky, wondrous time? What's the story that helps you or helped you, the one that stayed with you? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Share your holiday story with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Love and understanding. Merry Christmas, everyone. Time for party and celebration. People dancing all night long. Time for presents and exchanging kisses. Time for singing Christmas songs. We're gonna have a party tonight. We're gonna have a party tonight. I'm gonna find my girl underneath the mistletoe. Kiss by candlelight. Room is swaying, records playing, all the old songs we love to hear. Oh, I wish that every day was Christmas. What a nice way to spend the year. Oh, what a nice way to spend the year. Oh, yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Christmas stories, your Christmas holiday stories of family, food, trees, mishaps, wonder. We've got a lot on tape from listeners who called in response to our request to share. You can join us right now with your stories as well. What's your best Christmas story, holiday story? Fun, difficult, touching, beautiful? Have you had holidays that didn't start out so great but ended up perfect or good enough in a way that mattered? What's your favorite family Christmas story? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Lots of callers here, too. Matt in Binghamton, New York. Matt, thanks for calling. What's your story?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Okay, so when I was 8 years old, my sister, she said she found the Christmas presents, and she convinced me to take a look, and it was a Nintendo, and back then, Nintendos were a big deal. And so I let slip at school that I had found it, and my mom found out. And she told me she was taking it back to the store.
Because it was before, you found out before Christmas morning, or before it was time, okay.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so Christmas finally came around, and I didn't know whether she actually did or not. And so there was a bunch of Christmas presents under the tree, and we all take turns opening them. And my turn comes around, and I open it, and it's an empty box, just a box with nothing in it. And so I was pretty sad, and my mom tells me, oh, I guess we forgot to put something in there.
Yeah.
So we circle around again, and it's my turn again, and I open a box, and it's shoes. Except it's not like new shoes or anything. It's literally my shoes from the front door put in a box and given to me.
Teach you to look in early.
Yeah, so I'm at that point crying, and then my father comes out of the bedroom, and it's a brand new Nintendo.
Yeah.
And they have a picture of me, my face is red, tears are streaming down my face, holding that Nintendo, looking so happy.
Tears and a big goofy grin both on Christmas morning there, Matt.
Yes.
It's a good story. Thanks for sharing that. Got you back for learning early. Dave in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. Hey, Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
I just wanted to tell you, first and foremost, I love your show. I don't miss it. There's not a day that goes by that I don't listen to this.
That's wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. What's your story, Dave?
My Christmas story is my parents had left town. This was some years back. And for almost 8 years, I didn't celebrate Christmas. It just had lost kind of all of its meaning for me.
Yeah.
I met this girl at a bar here in town. I was the front man for a band, and she was the head bartender. And she found out that I did not celebrate Christmas. And we were kind of flirting with each other. And when she found this out, she absolutely demanded and would not take no for an answer that I come and enjoy Christmas at her house with her family.
Yeah.
At first, I was a little taken aback by it because it wasn't my thing. But I went, and I had the greatest time with her. And we fell in love pretty rapidly. We met, and 21 days later on New Year's, I proposed to her, and we've actually been married for going on 10 years now, and she's been the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
Well, that's a great love story, Dave. How did you get past, for people who haven't paid attention for a while, it can seem pretty corny, you know? They may not want to get into all that Christmas stuff. How did you get past it?
Honestly, it was her. I didn't have much interest in it, and with all of my family scattered, you know, to the four points, I didn't see the need for it, and she rekindled something in me that had been missing for a long time. It's one of those situations where I didn't really know that it was missing until she showed it to me, and it was her family and her love of Christmas that helped me see the importance of it. And every year now, like I said, we've been together for almost 10 years, and every year I buy more and more Christmas stuff and put it up for her, and I try not to be too grumpy about it because I know how much she loves it.
Yeah.
And to tell you the truth, I'm starting to love it too.
It's great. It's great. Love conquers all and brings back the holiday in a love story right there out of Omaha. Dave, thank you very much for your call, and same greetings to you. Here's a listener from Savannah, Georgia, John Martin Taylor. He called in to tell us about one of the most memorable gifts he was ever given.
We lost our mother 33 years ago to leukemia. She was only 62 and young at heart, an avid sailor and a brilliant cook with a vast library of cookbooks, the best of which was her own handwritten collection of recipes recorded in the 40s and 50s. When Mama got sick, our father became the cook at home. Several years after she died, he married Lila, a much younger woman. Their prenuptial agreement was basically that he would shop and cook and she would clean. When they moved aboard their boat, I inherited Mama's cookbooks, except for a few gems that my father kept for himself, the best of which was that old college notebook. Invariably, my siblings and I would call Daddy at Christmas, desperate for a cookie recipe. For while Mama was an exceptional cook, she never really taught us how. When handling the boat became more work than fun, Daddy and Lila bought a simple house on a canal in Florida. That landlocked Christmas, my father, at 72, bought himself a computer, taught himself how to type, and painstakingly copied the fragile pages of Mama's manuscript, recipe by recipe, page by page. By then, he had been the cook at home for over 10 years. While Daddy transcribed Mama's notes, Lila baked. For Christmas that year, each of us four kids received not only a copy of the marvelous recipes, but also tens of cookies, a dozen each of a dozen varieties, each labeled with a recipe title and page number in the book. It was the most thoughtful gift that I've ever received, and I continue to find wonderful ideas among the recipes. The notebook also contains her lengthy and precise directions for making Danish pastry from scratch, which we always had first thing on Christmas morning before we went outside for oysters and champagne, before the ham biscuits, the quail, the ambrosia, the cookies, and the eggnog. Now that I've got the recipes, I still don't see how she managed it all.
That wonderful story from John Martin Taylor in Savannah, Georgia. That one hits close to home. Christmas has all kinds of memories and emotions attached to it, and recipes brought to life and pushed right forward and savored. Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Camille, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My mother grew up in the Depression, and she always told us a story about how when she was growing up in a family of eight, they didn't have money for Christmas or anything like that. But they had a neighbor who had who was a little bit well-to-do, and one year that neighbor brought home a Christmas tree that was too big to fit in their living room. So they cut off the top of it and reshaped the tree, and they brought the top over to my mother's family. And that was their first Christmas, this little two-foot tree that they decorated and kind of made a Christmas around it. And the neighbors were so thrilled, and everybody was so thrilled with it, that every year thereafter, the neighbor continued to bring home a tree that was too big to fit in their living room so they could cut the top off and bring it to my mother's house.
I love it. Just lop the top off and bring it on. A too tall tree. Camille, I love that story. One more right here. Underhill, Vermont. Cheryl, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a story really more about my older brother. So I wasn't around at the time, but we heard about it over the years. And, you know, when he was little, and also when I was little, Santa had a really big job to, you know, put all the toys together. Things didn't come pre-assembled. And so one Christmas when my brother was really small, probably about two, he happened to go downstairs to where the Christmas tree was, and he saw my dad under the Christmas tree, and he got very upset, and he ran upstairs, and he either went and found my mother or my aunt, because my aunt used to always stay with us Christmas Eve, and he said, "Santa came, and Dad is busting all my toys."
Poor Dad, trying to put them together. It looked like busting to pieces to your brother.
Yeah, he was just so distraught. So we heard about that over the years.
Santa came, and Dad is busting all the toys. Cheryl, thank you very much for that from Underhill, Vermont, no less. Here's a story that came in from Bloomington, Illinois, my hometown, from Judy, the story of a family trip to her aunt's house through a snowstorm.
This was Christmas in the early 80s, and our two children were 11 and 14. We decided to drive from Bloomington, Illinois, to Crested Butte, Colorado, where our aunt lived. We set out on a snowy Thursday, and the normally 70-minute drive to Springfield took nearly 3 hours. We stayed overnight and woke up to a sunny day on Friday. We got off at Interstate 70 at Lyman, Colorado, thinking that we would reach Colorado Springs in about an hour. We barely got out of Lyman because at dusk, the snow began falling. After all, we were Flatlanders, but we were used to snow. As snowfall arrived, we found a roadway inn on U.S. 24, and we said, "Let's stay the night." The next morning, we woke up, and it was quiet. Our 11-year-old son tried to open the motel door, but he couldn't. It was stuck shut. We gulped. The proprietor said, "You'll be here for Christmas because then the storm will stop." Ha ha. The next day was Christmas Eve, and we were going nowhere. The motel office had a few little things to eat. Cereal, small containers of milk, tuna fish, hot dogs, and that's about all we had. The motel owners, and this is before the days of restaurants and motels or free breakfast or snacks. Christmas Day, our Christmas Day dinner, by the way, was bologna sandwiches, potato tots, green beans cooked in a little oven in the motel desk. The day after Christmas, we borrowed a snow shovel from the desk and shoveled out our little station wagon while watching a pickup truck with a big snow plow clear the motel parking lot. One more night, and we were on our way. We arrived at our aunt's house at 4 p.m. The dinner was navy bean soup, ham and beans, and the best that we ever had. Our son proclaimed, "This was the Christmas that never was." Merry Christmas, Tom.
The Christmas that never was. Stuck in the motel and too much snow to even get out the door. 800-423-8255. We welcome your Christmas stories. Andrew in Boston. Andrew, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah, what's your story?
So when I was a sophomore in college in 2008, in November, I was up on a retreat with my college in New Hampshire. And on the solo time, I climbed a tree, fell out of the tree, and ended up breaking my back. And couldn't move my feet, couldn't move my legs, and spent the next about six or seven weeks in the Spalding Rehab Center, doing inpatient rehab. Prior to injuring myself, I had already purchased my mine and my sister's flights to go home at Christmas. And so I had asked the hospital if I'd be able to use that, not wanting to waste the tickets. I wanted to use that as the date that I was released from the hospital. And it seemed to line up okay. And so, we went from the hospital to the airport. My sister and I, first time traveling in, you know, now in a wheelchair.
Yep.
And in a back brace.
Yep.
And ended up taking a few different connections, making our way, getting stuck in Albuquerque for the night because of some weather and some plane mechanical issues. Our flights were delayed, and we missed the last flight out of Albuquerque.
Oh.
Had to make our way over to the hotel with all of our stuff and with the wheelchair, and didn't have the medication that I needed. And
ouch.
Finally, in the morning, we get home, and it was quite a moment to come home, be back in Salt Lake, and be able to start kind of rebuilding my new life, kind of starting with a really great family holiday, and friends came over and kind of brought me right back into the fold, kind of getting ready to restart and rebuild and recover.
6 weeks in rehab and then a long flight home with your sister, but you made it, Andrew.
Yes, and of course my family didn't let me off the hook at all. My father said he's looking forward to me and my attendant coming home, and my sister said, "Well, I think I'll let Tiny Tim speak for himself." But it was a great Christmas, and you know, God truly did bless each one of us, so it fit.
Everyone, a little Tiny Tim story there, and Andrew, I really appreciate your sharing it. Thank you very much for calling. Here's one from Helen O'Connor, 86-year-old listener from Palm Harbor, Florida. She gave us this story about her favorite Christmas surprise from way back.
It was a very cold, snowy Christmas Eve, 1944, Syracuse, New York. I was 14 years old, and the star on the flag and the window on our front window of our house was a star for my brother, 17 years old, and my brother-in-law. My sister, who was married and 3 months pregnant, was living with us, and her husband was flying B-25s in England, and my brother enlisted in the Navy at age 17 and was on an aircraft carrier in the Atlantic. We had not heard from them, either boy, for a while, and we were very concerned. We came home from Mass. It was very, very late. Snow had fallen outside in Syracuse. My mom and dad had gone to bed, and I sat alone in the living room with our tree, wishing so much that my brother were there with me like old times. As I climbed the stairs for bed, for a minute I thought I heard his sharp whistle. I waited and said, "It must be just my wish to hear it again." I walked into my bedroom, up the stairs, into my bedroom, over to the window. The street light was on, and as I looked out, I heard the whistle again, and there, under the street light, was my brother in his navy pea coat and white sailor hat, looking up at the house. I screamed, "It's Bud, he's home." He had come in on the train and then got a cab up to the end of the street, and he wanted to walk the short distance and surprise us. And he sure did, and it turned out to be our very best Christmas.
A brother home from war in 1944, all by surprise and standing there in the snow. And yeah, I bet that did make a good Christmas. Helen in Palm Harbor, Florida, thank you very much for sharing that. Robert in Dalzell, South Carolina. Robert, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom.
Hey.
My story was, I was stationed out in New Mexico. My brother-in-law and sister-in-law, they were living in El Paso. They came up for Christmas. I was getting ready to deploy shortly thereafter. In-laws live in Missouri. They showed up at the house bringing gifts for the kids. He was dressed as Santa. We were not expecting them. Mother-in-law stayed out at the truck that was parked around the corner. He came up the door, bought some gifts for the kids, hung out for about 10 minutes. Then my brother-in-law and I went back out to the garage. We're like, "Is that who we thought it was?" And sure enough, about 20 minutes later, they showed up dressed normally. And we just had no clue they were coming. The kids were ecstatic. I mean, they thought Santa made it to them to bring them personal gifts, and they had driven through that blizzard to get to us.
That's pretty great. How far did they come, Robert?
From Missouri to, it was about 12 hours.
So across Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, all the way into New Mexico, dressed like Santas to bring you those gifts.
Yes, sir.
Well, when you're about to be deployed, that's got to be a pretty good feeling, and I appreciate your sharing that story with us. We're talking this hour about Christmas stories, your Christmas stories of family, food, trees, mishaps, wonder. holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, you name it, let's have it. What's the story that gets you laughing, crying at Christmas? Or the one that you survived, the one that opened up your table, your heart? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. And we'll hear in a few minutes about how the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer came to be. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let us hear from you.
Come together for this Christmas. Sing along. Sing it like,
ooh, ooh, ooh. Sing along.
Sing along. Oh, it's a celebration of laughter, joy, and love.
Sing it like, ooh, ooh, ooh. Sing along.
Sing along.
We'll sing it for you.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about Christmas stories, holiday stories of your family lore, you can join us. What's your best Christmas story, holiday story of friendship, lunacy, love? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. We asked for stories from you, and you very generously shared. I've got more, and we're going to hear about the origins of the Rudolph, the Red-Nosed Reindeer story in a minute as well. Behind us right there, well, Leslie Odom Jr. with, you know, Have Yourself a Merry. Dave in Southington, Connecticut. Dave, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When my grandmother was a little girl, she heard in elementary school that the class needed a location for the Christmas party, so she very generously volunteered their house.
Mm-hmm.
So she came home, told her mother, and her mother said, well, this is interesting, but your father is the holiest, most pious, devout Jewish man in Portland, Maine, and he's not going to go for this.
Okay.
So they figured out it was wintertime, and they could, since the parlor was blocked off, they could set up the parlor with a Christmas tree. Nobody would go in there. Nobody would know. The party would take place.
Okay.
As it happened the day before, the old man happened to open the door to the parlor, confronted his wife, found out that his daughter had committed them to having a Christmas party in their house. He immediately pronounced his daughter dead, went across the street to the synagogue and started saying Kaddish, the prayers for the dead. He is dead to her.
I hope that didn't last.
So my grandmother was obviously very upset. She's a little girl. She didn't think she did anything wrong.
Yeah.
And she tearfully says to her mother, what do we do? And so her mother convened all the matriarchs, and they were an Orthodox Jewish family, and they Talmudically reasoned out that the greater injustice would be to deny the children their party. So she said, well, what about Papa? And my great-grandmother, who was reportedly a very intelligent woman, said, don't worry, I'll fix it with him. So somehow a Christmas party took place in the house of the holiest, most devout Jewish man in Portland, Maine, a century ago.
And even after Kaddish for your grandmother, it all got patched up. Dave, I really appreciate your sharing that story. That's just fantastic. Thank you very much for that. Here's Sheldon, a longtime listener from Columbia, South Carolina, with a story about Christmas with his family.
My dad did 30 years in the military. Thanks to the Lord above, I did 10. I'm now medically retired, married with kids, my lovely wife, and my beautiful 10-year-old and all that. I used to live in Richmond, Virginia, before my dad went off to the Vietnam War, 68, 69, and my grandparents were there. They were in Richmond, Virginia on Maggie Walker Avenue, which subsequently is where Arthur Ashe's cousins were on that same street. Anyway, my Christmas story is I always believe the story about the flying reindeer. And so in our little house in Richmond, Virginia, way back in the day, probably when I was in grade school, I probably was like 6, 7, 8, somewhere around there. And this was probably in the late 60s, early 70s. I looked out my window because I wanted to see if I could see Santa Claus and the reindeer. And so all night long before Christmas, on Christmas Eve, I kept looking out the window. Finally, I saw what I thought looked like maybe Santa Claus' sleigh and maybe the reindeer, you know, walking around. Well, the next day when I woke up, the house was full of Christmas presents. You know, our proverbial Christmas tree with the light that reflected the different colors. I figured Santa Claus must have come there. The reindeer must have been walking around in my yard and all that. That's how I got all them wonderful presents. Of course, I know now. Well, my daughter would say, well, you should be believing in Santa Claus. And whether you believe in Santa Claus or not, it's not that that much matters in all that. Christmas is from the heart. On the birth of our dear Lord and Savior Jesus. God bless you all. Happy New Year. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. And happy Boxing Day. I got that from Great Britain. Cheers.
Got that from Great Britain. Thank you, Sheldon, in Columbia, South Carolina. And here's one from one of our producers, Nick Anderson, telling his story of making a traditional holiday French dessert for French class in high school.
The senior year of high school, I was in a very difficult French class with Madame Beatrix Fouzet-Prescop. And at the end of the first semester, she had the opportunity for us to get extra credit by making a traditional French dessert. Two of my friends and I signed up to make desserts, and we thought we would go all out and make a traditional bûche de Noël, a French Yule log. If you've never seen a French bûche, it's essentially sponge cake wrapped up on itself with a bunch of frosting and a bunch of little sugared tchotchkes like mushrooms and chipmunks and squirrels. It's really complicated, and I was really committed to making the whole thing, but my friend Emmy decided that that wasn't worth the time, and she drove us to the gourmet grocery store. We bought a gourmet bûche de Noël, stripped it of all of the decorative items, and covered it in Duncan Hines so that it looked like we had made our own bûche. And in class, I was nervous because we had trained ourselves how to say all the different ingredients in the bûche so that when Madame Fouzet asked us what was in it, we could say reasonably, oh, it's de la farine and le chocolat, etc. But as she chopped into it, she opened it up and noticed that there was raspberry jam inside, and we had no idea that there was raspberry jam inside. And so she said, oh, la confiture de framboise, quelle surprise. And Emmy turned and said, oh, oui, quelle surprise. And I lost it, and I just started shaking and laughing and also crying because I knew that our you know, that the jig was up. But she never noticed that we were losing it. And if she realized that we had not made this beautiful bûche in a while, because it was really quite delicious and beautiful, I got 15 points extra credit, so I guess I'm confessing it now. I didn't make that bûche, Madame Fouzet, and I'm sorry if you thought I did.
A little Christmas revelation there on the Christmas bûche from our producer, Nick Anderson. I want to thank all of our listeners around the country who sent in Christmas stories in this hour. And thanks for yours. If you've called or written into us, we'd love to have those. Just fantastic. In a moment, we're going to look at the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. There may be more of a story behind that story than you know. Stick with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen. But do you recall the most famous reindeer of all?
Rudolph. Well, of course you know Rudolph. We all know the story of that shiny red nose and how he saved Christmas when he guided Santa's sleigh on a foggy Christmas Eve. What you might not know is how Rudolph came to be. Joining me now with that story from Roanoke, Virginia, is Ronald Lankford, author of the book that tells how Rudolph came to be, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, an American Hero. Ronald, Ronnie, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom. Good to be here.
What are we listening to right here? There have been so many recordings of this. What have we got here, Ronnie?
Gene Autry. This is the classic recording from 1949, it sounds like to me.
Did he know it was going to be a big hit?
I don't think anybody knew for sure, but Columbia Records was sure counting on it being a big hit, and so they put a lot into it.
Where did Rudolph come from? I mean, we've got all kinds of Christmas lore that goes back. I mean, Santa Claus himself, kind of a 19th century creation in the current American mold anyway. Where did Rudolph come from, Ronnie?
Well, if you look at trying to trace the roots of Santa Claus, you're right. You go back to the 19th century, and it comes from a lot. Santa comes from a lot of different cultures. Rudolph comes from a very specific place and time. A story has circulated for a long time, it still circulates, that says that Robert L. May, the author of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, wrote Rudolph to comfort his daughter. She was 5 years old at the time. And her mother, Robert L. May's wife, Margaret, was dying of cancer. And that was true. She was. And he wrote this story to help comfort his daughter. But the truth of the story is that Robert L. May was working for Montgomery Ward at the time.
Montgomery Ward, which was the big department store, lots and lots of locations around the country back in the day. Not now, but big then.
Huge then. Sears would have been a little bigger, but so they were competing with Sears. And one of the ways they chose to compete was to come up with a Christmas story that they could use as a promotion. So probably January of 1939, they asked Robert L. May to come up with a story that they could promote at the Christmas season.
Now, he did have a daughter, and he did have a wife who was having significant health problems, right?
That's right. And even while he was working in 1939, she would die in that summer. And they at Montgomery Ward, they actually offered to take the project away from him because they felt like he needed some time to, you know, rest. But it was real important to him that he finished this, and so he continued to work on it. So,
and this is an in-house copywriter from Montgomery Ward, the big catalog and department store company. They asked him for a Christmas story that might, what, they could give away in the stores, would bring people in to shop. This is Robert May is a Jewish guy.
Well, people have pointed that out, too. A lot of our famous Christmas songs were also written by Jewish writers.
Yeah.
And so, but I think for Robert L. May, with his own background, he had been picked on as a child. He had skipped a grade, and so he stood out a little. And so I think he saw the story of Rudolph, you know, being about an underdog like himself.
So he skipped a grade, so he was the little kid in class, or the younger kid in class.
Yeah, very much so.
Wow. Was he bullied by his classmates?
Yes, he was bullied, and again, I think that's why he related to this character, this underdog, so much, and gave him, you know, the red nose, made him a little bit different, and with his unique personality.
And so out of that, we get Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. What was the first form of it? Did he write it in book form for Montgomery Ward right away? Did he tell it to his daughter? How did it emerge?
Well, he worked on it. I find it fascinating the way he did work on it. He took a lot of time. He had big load at work already. And so he started working on Rudolph, and he wanted to make sure he got it right. He was afraid that it would just be another one of these Christmas stories that just go by the wayside. So he actually had his daughter and some kids in the neighborhood would come over, and they would listen to him read portions of it. And so he thought if they believed it, that, you know, he had gotten it right at that point.
He's in Chicago. We're talking 1939, 33-year-old ad man at Montgomery Ward, his wife dying of cancer, he with the bullying in his own background, and up comes this story. What did Montgomery Ward think of it when he turned it in for their Christmas project?
Well, to begin with, they weren't too sure about it. A lot of people thought that red noses had something to do with people who had too much to drink. And they were worried about that association. And so it took a while to convince them. They had to do some sketches and to show Rudolph as an attractive young deer with a nose that wasn't too big as far as the redness goes. And finally, they were able to convince Montgomery Ward that this was a good promotion.
How did it go when they printed it up and handed it out to customers?
They printed up 2.5 million copies. As you mentioned, they had hundreds of stores at the time. And so the promotion was a gigantic success. They probably printed too few copies. One of the things, when you look back now, their design with this whole campaign was to bring people into the store. But there was not even a plush Rudolph doll that you could have bought at the time. The main design of the campaign was just to bring people into the stores, parents with their kids, and then they would give them a free copy. But they gave away about 2.5 million copies and probably underestimated how popular Rudolph was going to be.
And on it went from there. The music became incredibly popular. Gene Autry's, I think, biggest hit ever, 2.5 million copies is his greatest hit. Everybody sang it. Ella Fitzgerald and Bing Crosby, Destiny's Child, Dean Martin, rapper DMX, The Temptations, Burl Ives, and then a movie as well. This thing just kept plowing deeper into the Christmas culture.
Yeah, F. Scott Fitzgerald in another era said there are no second acts in American life, but that was never true for Rudolph. The timing, I think, is interesting because Robert May wrote this promotion for Montgomery Ward in 1939. 1949, Johnny Marks, who is Robert May's brother-in-law, writes the song for Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and that becomes a gigantic hit in 49. And then in 1964, which is 25 years after May wrote the promotion for Montgomery Ward, you have the Rankin and Bass Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which everybody remembers. So Rudolph had a really good run and established himself quickly. If you look at Santa Claus, you probably go back to the 1840s. It would take quite a while for our traditions of Santa Claus to settle in. With Rudolph, within 25 years, he is an accepted part of our Christmas mythology.
Our time is short, but we thank Robert L. May for coming up with it. What do you think it is essentially that made Rudolph so popular, made Rudolph stick?
Well, I think that if you look at Santa Claus, everybody loves Santa Claus. He is an older man, sort of a grandfather figure.
Mm-hmm.
With Rudolph, he's a child. And so when children look at him and look at his heroic acts, they want to be Rudolph. They want to save the day for the adult like Rudolph did for Santa Claus. And I think that's it's hard not to like that.
Ronald Ronnie Lankford is author of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and American Hero. Hard to argue with that. Ronnie, good Christmas to you. Thanks very much for being with us. Thanks for telling this story.
Thank you, Tom. Merry Christmas.
Same to you. Listeners, same to all. Thanks so much for being with us today. Here's Chuck Berry. Run, Rudolph, run. And off we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Run, run, Rudolph. Santa's got to make it to town. Santa, make him hurry. Tell him he can take the freeway down. Run, run, Rudolph. I'm reeling like a man.